welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and it's really great that you've decided to join us today. In the last few years, there are few topics that have come to the minds of Americans more than policing, and specifically the relationship between police officers and citizens. And even more specifically, the relationships between police officers and African Americans. Since the very public police murder of George Floyd in Minnesota almost 3 years ago, we have had a more earnest set of talks about what policing is and what it isn't, how and whether police departments can change, and what people need to reduce harm and be safe as they try to exist and thrive in their own communities. These conversations are not going away anytime soon, in part because we continue to see tragedies unfold, and police departments are often at the center of those tragedies. The most recent high-profile event, of course, is the police killing of Tyre Nichols, who was beaten by several police officers in Memphis, Tennessee, and later died in a hospital. Now, we talk about this subject a lot on this show. We talk about the incidents when they happen, and we talk about the context here, that relationship between police and African Americans, what's wrong with it, whether it can be reformed or changed, and what we need to do to get to a better space. But after the killing of Tyre Nichols, I couldn't help but think about history, and especially history here in the city of Detroit. When you think of violent police departments, I don't know how Detroit couldn't come to your mind, at least in a historical sense. This was the home of Stress, a police squad created to stop the robberies and enjoy straight, safe streets, as it was so called. The Big Four, the Gang Squad. These are names that are very familiar to people who've lived here in the past and to those of us who still live here today. Now, we are trying to reform policing in Detroit, just as they are trying to reform policing in other cities. And I think it would be unfair not to give a lot of credit to the leadership of the Detroit Police Department for those efforts. But the history here looms large over all of that and hangs forever in the minds of those who are the victims of police violence, who were the victims of police violence, and who remember a city where, if you were African American, you had every reason to be terrified just by the sight of a police officer. So we want to spend some time today talking about that history, how we got to this place in Detroit today, where we are actually talking about real reform, whether it can happen, and how it should happen. And I want to start that conversation with somebody I know who has been thinking and researching about this topic for a really long time. Danielle McGuire is an adjunct professor at the University of Utah. She's an author, and she's a former professor of history here at Wayne State, which is where I met her. She's been on the show several times in the past to talk about policing and violence, and she's also currently working on a book that focuses on the history of police violence here in the city of Detroit. A little later in the show, we're going to be joined by Ike McKinnon, a former police chief here in Detroit, who has a lot of experience with this issue, both as a kid growing up in Detroit, as well as an officer and then as a chief. We'll also be joined by Jack Kresnick, who's a former law enforcement reporter with the Detroit Free Press, somebody who covered lots of the history of policing here in Detroit. But I'm really pleased to welcome Danielle back to Detroit today to kick off this conversation. Danielle, it's really great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. It's wonderful to be back in Detroit.
Yes, that's right. So I want to start with this book that you're working on, which is about murders that took place at the Algiers Motel on July 26th, 1967. That's a very important date and a very important period of time here in Detroit's history. But take us back to that point and time and talk about why you want to write about that moment in Detroit's history and how that relates to the things I was talking about in the open, this history of really outsized police violence against African Americans in Detroit.
Yeah, I think that case in particular is probably one of the most brutal examples of police violence and obfuscation after the fact that we saw during a very short period of time, you know, just a few days in 1 week, in 1 month, in 1 year. And if we zoom in on that particular case and the context surrounding it, I think we get a really horrific picture of police violence, of cover-up, of corruption, of collusion between the detectives, the medical examiners, the courts, the prosecutors. And part of the reason why I was really interested in this story is because I think it's one of the few cases where you start to see very clearly the infrastructure of injustice that is at work in a northern city. But particularly around issues of police violence. And, you know, part of the problem with even getting to the crux of a lot of these issues is that the archive is so silent. You know, we get a police report, people assume that's the truth, and everything goes from there. But what happens when the police report is a lie? What happens if there are multiple reports submitted, but you only see the final one, the one that is written to be most exculpatory towards the police? In this 1 week and this one particular case provided an opportunity to see lots of layers of what happened because we had multiple investigations. And that kind of created a better archive than what we normally have, which I think enables us to tell a more full story of what happened so that we can get to the point where we can start to think about a real reckoning with our history, a kind of reconciliation, and move towards some kind of justice, even if it's just restorative justice in the sense of telling the story the right way and giving credit due to the victims and the survivors and the family members who have suffered for decades with the impunity of violence done to their families.
And for those who may not know, we should be clear that what was happening on July 26th, 1967 was the uprising here in Detroit, a pushback by the Black community against years and years of police brutality and police violence. And I think right there, we have an opportunity to kind of expose the tensions that exist around that narrative. Those of us who call it an uprising are describing the reaction of the Black community to what had been happening to us for a really long time in Detroit. People who call them riots, I think it's fair to say, are downplaying that dimension of it. This idea that that there was a systemic, as you point out, effort to not only brutalize African Americans in the city of Detroit, but to cover up the fact that it was happening, I think comes to a very sharp point during those days in 1967 when essentially the city boils over with anger at what had been happening.
Yeah, and I think what you also see very clearly, at least what I see in the research files and the police records and the FBI records, is the police boiling over during that week and really losing absolute control. They terrorized the Black community that week. And I know some people will get upset with me saying that, but those are the facts. And on the night that police murdered Aubrey Pollard, Carl Cooper, and Fred Temple at the Algiers Motel, which was really late Tuesday night, July 25th, into the 26th, they also just went wild on the near West Side and killed a bunch of other people. A number of those people they didn't file reports about. They only maybe mentioned it later after a newspaper started to do an investigation. I'm thinking in particular of the murder of William Dalton on Grand River, who was picked up by the police after he was walking home. They accused him of being out past curfew, but also of starting a fire at a warehouse. He, of course, wasn't near the fire, but they persisted. And they ended up cornering him. He was surrounded by a group of police officers, and they goaded him to run. He was a teenager, probably scared to death, and probably unsure of what to do, but knew at that moment, like so many Black teenagers probably did at that time and still do today, felt that his life was probably threatened. And for whatever reason, he made the decision to run. And the minute he turned away from the police officers, a patrolman raised a shotgun and fired shot and killed him. And then that group of police officers left. They left the scene. They didn't file a report. They didn't say anything. They didn't report it. And other officers driving past the area later found the body and reported it as a dead sniper. Okay, so the very first instance in the records is that he is a sniper. 30 witnesses saw exactly what happened. And they saw the police arrest him, curse him out, roughhouse him, threaten him. They heard police dare him to run. And then they saw police shoot him. And, weeks after the uprising, when, there were no arrests made in his murder, family and friends called the Detroit News. And they told a different story than what the police had been telling. And this is similar in a lot of these cases of that week in particular, but even today. And the Detroit News did a story which really forced the police department to open an investigation. They interviewed a lot of the same people that had called the news, and they determined, this is the Detroit and the Homicide Bureau, they determined that witness testimony was contradictory. It wasn't credible. And so they decided it was a justified homicide. Every single case, when you look back, with the exception of the few people who died of arson or who were electrocuted, the story is very similar. Mm-hmm. And there are very discernible patterns that you can't unsee once you start digging in.
Yeah, yeah. And we should be clear that what you're describing is, this stretch of time during the uprising when all of these things hit a particular apex in terms of, how bad right. they are, but that this was a pattern that had been present with African Americans in our communities for many, many years. If you go back not too long before 1967 to 1943, we can talk about the uprising and the riots then, the police riot, essentially, that's right. unleashed on African Americans. This was the culture of policing in the city for such a long time. And I think it's hard sometimes to get people to quite understand the breadth and depth of that culture.
I totally agree with what you're saying. And I think that's what makes this week so unique in terms of our ability to really study it, is that it exposes that those practices and that systemic behavior that is, the officers are used to doing this, right? They're this is not unusual behavior for the week. They may have felt a little less constrained because so much of what they did could be covered up by just saying, you know, this is a, quote, riot-related death, or they could blame it on these elusive snipers that, you know, no one ever really found. But it exposes a practice and a culture and a system. And that practice, culture, and system is what I think we're still dealing with today because we didn't deal with it then, right? The fact that in almost all of the cases where there were very clear discrepancies and outright lies in police killings just that week alone, you know, all of them were considered justifiable homicide in a very perfunctory examination by the Wayne County prosecutor. And it was like, you know, that he looked at some paperwork and decided that was it. It was done. No one had their day in court. There was no compensation. There's no discussion. And then right after the uprising ends, the police in many ways are rewarded. They're rewarded because they're given more leeway in the rules that allow use of force. They're given more militaristic equipment and more funding. And they're given the benefit of the doubt over and over and over again. You know, they're acquitted in cases where they are brought to trial, as in the Algiers case. And so you just, this is why I think people today call this state-sanctioned violence, right? State-sanctioned terror, because you see so many layers of the state supporting and approving and enabling police violence and the cover-up of that violence. Mm-hmm. So if we can zoom in and see it so clearly this week, I think it's really important that we zoom out and look at it more holistically. Like, how was that behavior set up in the past that led to police killings in 1967? How did impunity for officers who murdered citizens during the uprising affect the creation of stress, mm-hmm, and the kind of wild behavior of officers in that unit in the 1970s, and how does their impunity, right, and our sort of brushing away that part of the past, you know, forgetting about it, ignoring it, set up a system where we're still dealing with the exact same problem today?
Yes, yes. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Danielle McGuire about policing in Detroit, the violent history of policing in Detroit. We're going to add some other voices to the conversation as well. Ike McKinnon, retired deputy mayor and former Detroit police chief, will join us to talk about his understanding and his knowledge of the history of policing in Detroit. Also, Jack Kresnick, a retired journalist who worked for the Detroit Free Press for 38 years, covered a lot of different police issues while he was there. He will call in and join the conversation as well. We also want to get going with you, our listeners, on the phones. 313-577-1019 is the number. Tell us what you make of the efforts to reform police, but also the history of policing here in Detroit. Have you seen it change over the year? Do you think it's changing for the better? Give us some examples. Give us some sense of the things that you've experienced as a Detroiter. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
Bringing you news that matters.
Stories that impact your life.
Music from the Motor City and around the world.
This is 1019 WDET,
Detroit's NPR station.
This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and it's really great that you're with us today. My guest right now is Danielle McGuire. She's an adjunct professor at the University of Utah, an author, and former professor of history at Wayne State University. She's working on a book about the murders of several black men at the Algiers Motel during the 1967 uprising by Detroit police officers. We're talking about the history of violent policing in Detroit and what it tells us about the things that we see today, the things that we react to when they happen in other communities, the killing of George Floyd, the beating death of Tyree Nichols. All of these things are connected in a really important way in our country and in our history. I want to add another voice to the conversation right now. Ike McKinnon is a retired deputy mayor of our city and also a former Detroit police chief. He's also somebody who's had experience on both sides of this equation, having been in charge of the police, of course, but also having been someone who had to fear and run from the police before he was part of the department. Ike, it's really great to have you back here on Detroit Today.
Stephen, thank you so much. As I was listening to Dr. McGuire recall the things that are happening, were happening in 1967, I flashed back to, as you know, Stephen, my incident being shot at by fellow officers, and number two, being beaten up when I was 14 years old. And those are things that you just never, ever forget. And I'm listening to Danielle, and I started getting chills as she was talking about the things that occurred. It is not a happy moment for anyone to go through those kinds of incidents.
Yeah. So Ike, one of the things that I think you can help us do is put all this history in context, but also cast it forward to the time when you were police chief and the time since then. Of course, things look somewhat different, of course, now than they did then. But I think that history still really informs a lot of the conversations that we're having and a lot of the things that we're seeing. But let's start with you talking about how you grew up, in Detroit and the fear that you had of police in the city and why.
Sure. I certainly grew up in Detroit, raised partially in the Brewster Projects and just north of there, for the medical center area. And Stephen, I saw in my time, I only saw two African-American police officers. I also saw on a regular basis white police officers, in particular the Big Four, who would grab young black men and throw them up against the walls, beat them up, and just take off. They would pull out their shotguns and their weapons, and just they would hold other people, other black people, against the wall, and just take off. And of course, everybody in my neighborhood, we saw this, and it became a regular thing. And it was one of those situations where you said, "When is this going to stop? Or how can we make a difference with these kinds of things occurring?" And so when I was 14, I was severely beaten up by the Big Four as I was leaving my first day of school at Cass Tech. My first day, I stopped and beaten by these guys, and they were laughing so brutal. And other black people were trying to stop them. And of course, they took off on them also. So that incident set the tone for my life in terms of wanting to become a Detroit police officer and make a difference, to change that kind of those kinds of actions against anyone. And ironically, Stephen, as I grew up and became a Detroit police officer in 1965, some of the white officers would say to me, you know, "I don't know how you guys," meaning us black officers, "can put up with this stuff." And they would, in particular, the white officers who kind of grew up the same as I did, poor, they said, you know, this happened to them too. So it was not just black people. Mm. It was poor white people that these officers would beat up.
Mm. And when you grow up to become a police officer, You've talked before on the show about the experience you had during the uprising. You were an officer at that point, but some fellow officers didn't know that you were and tried to kill you.
Stephen, I was in uniform. I was in uniform, and I was.
So they did know.
Oh yeah. I was going to my apartment on the west side of Detroit on Boston Avenue, and I had just left the second precinct where I was working. I had my uniform on, my badge, and a chew on my lapel, which said the second precinct. And these two officers pulled me over, and I stepped out of the car, and I had my uniform on. I raised my hand because my assumption was that everything was going to be okay. And as I've said before, they said tonight, and they use the racial and derogatory term, you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I didn't believe this was going to happen, but I could see this one officer, that officer with the brush cut and gray hair, as he started to pull the trigger. And either he or both of them shot at me as I dove back into my car. And I remember grabbing the steering wheel with my right hand, pushing the accelerator with my left hand, and sped off. They continued to shoot. Thank God they missed me. But that to me, it always stands out that, you know, why in the heck is this happening? Mm. But the reality is that we know there's some very serious racial problems mm-hmm. that existed then and still exist now.
Yeah. I want to add another voice to the conversation as well. Jack Kresnek is a former Detroit Free Press reporter. He was there for 38 years. He covered a number of different things, but also covered the Detroit police for a long time there. Jack, welcome to Detroit Today.
Good morning, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So the reason I wanted you to be here in particular, Jack, was some of the things that you saw and wrote about while you were a reporter at the Detroit Free Press. The time that you were there marks sort of the evolution of the Detroit police in some ways, but also there are many of these incidents where police brutalize black people in particular that you witnessed from that seat as a journalist. Talk about the things that you saw over time covering policing in the city of Detroit.
Well, I was there at Detroit Police Headquarters from about 1973 until about 1980. And it was a pretty horrific time in Detroit with a serious, serious crime problem. I think in 74, there were 800 homicides. And I believe that after the civil disturbance of 1967, that Detroit police took some, real serious and true criticism, that they kind of backed off and let that disturbance grow into a 5-day conflagration. And I think after that, there was a call in the department to more strongly enforce criminal laws. And one of those tactics that they used was develop stress, which was, as you pointed out, an acronym for something I can't recall right now. But and it, almost immediately, it resulted in the deaths of several black men by usually white officers.
Mm-hmm.
71-72 is particularly bloody there, and it kind of came to a head in March of 72 when officers from a stress unit followed a man they thought was armed with a weapon into an apartment building on Rochester Street. And it ensued in a gunfight between the on-duty stress officers and several off-duty Wayne County Sheriff's Department deputies who were just playing cards in that apartment. One sheriff's deputy was killed. A couple of others were injured. It was a complete screw up. And the there were three distress officers, all black, who were charged with that crime of shooting, but all three were acquitted, which is what happened in a lot of cases. There was a stress officer named Raymond Peterson involved in the killings of nine black men, five of whom died with bullets fired from his gun. And he was charged with second-degree manslaughter or murder, and ultimately acquitted. Very few convictions in criminal court resulted from the investigations of stress at the time. But I do think that when Mayor Young took office in 1974, that there was there began to be a period of a lot more accountability and transparency about what was going on. And there was no hesitation to firing officers. And Peterson was fired, even though he was acquitted in that killing.
So, Jack, I also would love for you to talk about the killing of Malice Green by two police officers, two white police officers in the early 1990s. And I guess how that demonstrated that despite all the efforts that Mayor Young and even Mayor Archer were making to reform the police department, there was still a culture that had hold of the department that harkened back to the time of 1967 and before.
Oh, yeah. It was a horrific beating of a black man named Malice Green, as you pointed out. And the officers seemed to be, well, it's hard to describe, but they were bent on vengeance or something. They just kind of went out of control. And there was a burgeoning civil disturbance happening outside of the location where that occurred. I was out there for that, and a very nice black man came up to me and said, you know, you better get out of here because they're getting a little crazy. Other reporters came to take my place, but it was the only time I really felt like maybe I shouldn't be in a situation like I was as a reporter. But I, you know, the attempts to hold the officers accountable went forward. There was a trial, as I recall. I can't remember. I think there was a conviction, but it appealed. But I don't remember for sure.
So, Ike McKinnon, I want to bring you back into the conversation as well. This is the time when you're in the leadership at the Detroit Police Department, and somebody who's trying to reform the department. Talk about where we were in the 1990s with this history of police violence.
Yes, Stephen. I became chief after this
malice. After that happened,
I think Stan Knox was chief during that time. But the thoughts and the ideas were there. For instance, I remember I was in Washington with all the major chiefs in the United States and deputy mayors too, and I told them of the incident that occurred with me. I told them of things that I had seen in police departments and what we all had to do to change or try and make a difference in our respective departments. And it was just interesting for me that no one said anything in terms of what they were going to do. This was certainly right after Rodney King, too. So we saw all these things occurring. My thoughts with Detroit was I had seen a great number of incidents that had occurred to me, that I had stopped things occurring to other people. It was important for me to get a team of people to work the same way that I wanted to do to make a difference within our city and within the police department. However, the culture, and I'm going to use this term probably a lot, the culture in a lot of law enforcement departments is that things are, you know, these people deserve that, and they will do whatever they have to do
to stop them from doing that. And it was always them versus us was the term that was used so often. And it was very difficult, even though you're in a leadership position. Certainly you couldn't fire everyone, and of course they had unions and so forth. But it was very difficult, Stephen, as whether the chief or as a city leader, to change everything and to stop all of these violent acts that were occurring, and it continued to do so.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break. I want to thank Jack Kresnik, Detroit Free Press reporter for 38 years, for being with us to talk about his experiences. We're going to keep Ike McKinnon and Danielle McGuire when we come back, and we're going to get to your calls and your social media comments. If you want to join us here, 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined us. My guests are Ike McKinnon. He's a retired deputy mayor of Detroit and former Detroit police chief, also a former Minneapolis Police Department consultant and a former professor at U of D Mercy. Also with us is Danielle McGuire. She is an adjunct professor at the University of Utah, an author and former professor here at Wayne State University. She's working on a book about the murders during the 1967 uprising of several black men at the Algiers Motel. We're talking about the history of police violence against citizens, against black citizens in particular, here in the city of Detroit. We want to hear from you as well during the conversation. Give us a sense of how you interpret some of the things that we see now in other cities. Tyre Nichols being beaten to death by police officers, George Floyd being murdered in Minneapolis 3 years ago. Do they remind you of things that happened here in the city of Detroit, the struggles we've had trying to keep people safe from the police in our communities? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation. Let's start today with Gene in Detroit. Gene, welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning, Stephen. I'd like your guest to comment on the similarities between the stress program here and the sting program in Tennessee known as Scorpion, where Tyre Nichols was killed. Mm-hmm. And if they can, estimate how many other sting-type programs are in existence in the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. That target young, low-income people.
Yeah. Gene, great question, and I'm glad you called to inject that. Danielle, stress is something that fewer and fewer people are old enough now, I think, to actually remember here in the city of Detroit, but it is an important part of our history. When I heard about this Scorpion unit in Memphis, it was one of the first things that jumped to mind was stress. So talk about the connection between these types of units and, as Gene asks, whether there are lots more like them in departments around the country.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm like you, Stephen. When I first heard about the Scorpion unit, I said, gosh, that sounds so familiar. And I didn't even go to some of the units that have been created more recently in places like Atlanta and New York and Los Angeles. I went to Detroit because it sounded exactly like what that was. And I think, you know, so many people, you know, either don't know the history or they have forgotten, except those, of course, who've lived it. But the stress unit, you know, was in the end a kind of terror squad. It was like the Vice Squad, the TMU, the Big Four on steroids. And these are supposed to be elite strike units that are sent to, you know, hot spots in cities. But so often they operate with almost complete impunity and outside the norms and rules of, you know, any kind of proper training or behavior. And they do it until something really horrific happens that becomes public. You know, you think about the Breonna Taylor case, right? That was part of a hotspot strike squad, the raid on her apartment, the wrongful raid on her apartment. And I think that's what happens in so many of these cases. And so, you know, that Scorpion squad has been around for a few years prior to this horrific beating and death. And what they were doing to Tyree Nichols, they were doing to people all around the community. And those people were complaining. There were protests. They were, you know, they filed reports. And, you know, in lots of ways, the city and the department, the chief, ignore those reports until they couldn't ignore them anymore. And I think that's what gets me so upset. I mean, among other things, about this case in particular is, you know, when you look at the very first report the officers submitted for in their encounter with Tyree Nichols, they lied, right? And the story that they told is exactly the same as the story that David Senek, Ronald August, and Robert Paley told the night that they murdered the three teenagers at the Algiers Motel. And it's the same story that officers told the whole week during the rebellion of people that they shot and killed. And it's the same story, I believe, that you see in almost every case of, you know, police killings, is that the suspect basically got himself killed because they fought back, they resisted arrest, they reached for the gun, they lunged, they did something that allegedly threatened the officer's life. And they count on those stories, often written by union lawyers with legal language that is exculpatory, in order to justify, you know, behavior that is not justifiable at all for a department that is charged with public safety, right? So the caller makes a really good point. And I think, you know, all of these units, they've come and gone, right? They started popping up in the late 60s and early 70s. Then after civil rights and Black Power protests, they kind of disappeared. Then they popped up again in different forms, but they're all doing kind of the same thing. And they almost all result in the same tragedies.
Yeah, yeah. Ike, when you were managing the police department, talk about the role of these kind of special squads. I can remember as a teenager growing up in the 1980s, the fear that we had, me and my friends, of the Big Four, who were still kind of roaming the streets, and we knew we just didn't want to come across them. But what role did you see for those kinds of units when you were in charge?
Well, we didn't have the Big Four. And the reason being, as I mentioned before, these are the kinds of things that I had witnessed. And so many people had complained to me and to other supervisors about these kinds of incidents occurring with them and to their friends. Now, one of the most important things here, number one, is the people that you recruit to become a law enforcement officer. That's number one. Number two is the other part of that would be the supervisors. But unfortunately, the supervisors are former police officers, and they maintain or manifest the same kinds of feelings and ideas as the officers. And so with those things working against you, you had to work so diligently to make sure that you had the right people, number one, as supervisors, and number two, as police officers. You know, I've watched this throughout the years and tried to rid our department, Detroit, of officers who had the propensity for committing these kinds of acts. But if you don't have supervisors, number one, and officers who will stop them. For instance, I told the story of as a sergeant at the 10th Precinct, I came across a number of officers severely beating some young kids. They're 14 and 15 years of age.
And I grabbed these officers. In fact, I locked up one of the officers at the time, but there was no one to back me up. My inspector at the time cussed at me because I stopped these officers from doing what they were doing. And his words to me was, these officers are just doing their job. And I said, but that's not their job, Inspector. Their job is to serve and protect the people of the city of Detroit, not beat them down to the ground as they were doing. So there was no backup for a sergeant or a supervisor who's trying to do his or her duty to stop these kinds of actions.
Yes.
Go ahead. Can I add to that? Yeah. Is that okay? There's no backup, and now there's court support for excessive use of force through qualified immunity. Mm-hmm. It's crazy how, in 1871, Congress passed an act called the Civil Rights Act of 1871. It became known as the Ku Klux Klan Act, and it was designed to protect Black people from racial violence, mostly committed by the Ku Klux Klan, but sanctioned by state and city officials, and who often participated in that violence. And that act has been so twisted by the courts to create this ridiculous concept of qualified immunity, where basically police are totally immune from liability in cases where they murder people who come into their custody or use such excessive force that they suffer for the rest of their lives. And that's something that we need to change. And I know Congress can do that, and the court can do that. So, when we talk about how we move forward, we have to reconcile with the past, but we also have to realize that, as much as individuals have tried to make progress in some districts and police units and departments, we have an overarching legal system that supports excessive force and that protects police who use it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if I could say that, I know you don't have that much time, but there has to be an establishment of trust between the community and the police. And that is not the case. And we continue to see these kinds of things occurring. And if it continues, it's going to get worse and worse and worse. And I mean, Stephen, you said you had a distrust of the Big Four and others. Every Black police officer that I've spoken to in this country has had similar incidents that we just talked about. Every Black man in Detroit that I grew up with has had incidents that occurred similar to mine with the police. Those are the kinds of things that create a systemic lack of trust within a community. And that has to, the police have to make the difference there. We have 860,000 police officers in this country, but we have 330 million people. Mm-hmm. Who should make the change?
Yeah. Okay. I would love to get to more of our callers and to social media, but we have run out of time. But I'm really grateful to you, Danielle McGuire, and Ike McKinnon, for all of the knowledge and understanding that you've lent to this conversation. It was really great to have both of you here. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
Today.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And a note to our callers, of course, this is not going to be the last time that we discuss policing or the relationship between police and citizens, or Black citizens in particular. Obviously, we will always try to make sure that you're an important part of the conversation here. Keep calling, and eventually we will, of course, get to you. That's going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow when we're going to be talking with a philosopher about why she thinks animals deserve more justice in our society. Also, if you like this show and enjoy listening to this program, if you get real value from the hour we spend every day together talking about these really important things, you ought to share that idea with your friends and your relatives and other people in your life. You can find us at WDET.org. You can find us wherever you download podcasts. We publish this as a podcast every day. We always want to grow the community that we have here at WDET and Detroit Today, and you're an important part of that growth. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.